Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. What if one of the best museums of American art was right in your own backyard? Would you go? Rinalda House Museum of American Art curator Allison Slaby sure hopes so. And now that you know, she's here to invite you on a tour of Hollywood's and Rinalda's golden age. Then from Tinseltown, we head off into the woods with three gifted child actors from First in Flight Theater Company. Their cast of fairy tale characters has plenty of attitude, and they're here to share. Karoff is back at the keyboard with Edvard Grieg. Longtime American Ballet Theater principal dancer Susan Jaffe shares the secrets of her success. And North Carolina composer Kenneth Frizzell explores the passage of time. It's poetry and composition and something else all wrapped up together in his new work, A Book of Days. It's all coming up next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. It's among the top five things all North Carolinians should do this month, according to Our State magazine. It's been called the top fashion exhibition this season by Lucky Magazine, and maybe most telling of all, the granddaughter of the man whose photography is being honored in this exhibit calls it the most creative installation of his work that she's ever seen. Now that's Star Power, Edward Steichen's glamour photography, and it's on view through May 19th at Rinalda House Museum of American Art in Winston-Salem. Star Power explores the golden age of Hollywood in the late 1920s through the 30s with Steichen's images of luminaries like Katharine Hepburn, Gary Cooper, Charlie Chaplin, Gloria Swanson, and many others. But the exhibit is unique in that it also ties together Hollywood's golden age with the golden age of Rinalda. Alongside the portraits by America's first modern fashion photographer, viewers can look at the amazing gowns, shoes, and Art Deco jewelry that members of the Reynolds family were wearing back then. Rinalda House curator Allison Slaby met me at the museum to explore this fascinating cross-dressing of art and couture.
You like, if Mae West you like, or me undress you like, why nobody will applaud.
Allison, who was Edward Steichen?
Edward Steichen was one of the most important early 20th century photographers, but he's also incredibly important to the story of modern art in America because he was living in Paris and he had a partnership with the photographer Alfred Stieglitz in New York, where Steichen would gather up the work of avant-garde European artists and take it to New York to exhibit in Stieglitz's Gallery 291. So the two of them, Steichen and Stieglitz, were the first to introduce the work of Matisse and Picasso and the sculptor Rodin to America. So this was really the introduction of modern art to America. And this exhibition examines a second part of his career after he returned from Paris. He was living in New York. He was convinced that he was going to devote his career to photography. And he took a job with Condé Nast, and he became the chief photographer for Vogue and Vanity Fair. So he brought this grounding in modern art, in aesthetic sensibilities, in technical mastery of photography to his work for the commercial realm. He's unique as an artist in that he really saw no difference between fine art and commercial art. And so he spent really 14 years dramatizing and glamorizing Greta Garbo and Gary Cooper and Gloria Swanson and all of these luminaries of Hollywood, in addition to people from cultural and other realms such as Winston Churchill and Amelia Earhart and Eugene O'Neill. And the work that he created for Condé Nast is really some of the most iconic photography of the early 20th century.
This particular exhibit here at Rinalda House, Star Power, has been garnering lots of praise from various sources and some very, very meaningful sources as well, as in within the family. What are you all doing in a unique way? What are you doing right?
Well, when we started looking at these images, we were really struck by the fact that the years that Steichen was working for Condé Nast, 1923 to about 37, were both the golden age of Hollywood, but also the golden age of Rinalda. These were the years that Catherine Smith Reynolds was living in the house, buying furniture for the estate, buying fine clothing for herself. The same thing happened in the next generation with her oldest daughter, Mary. So we were struck by the fact that there was so much visual resonance between Steichen's photographs and costumes in our costume collection, furniture that we have in the house, even jewelry that the family owned. And so we decided to create an installation within the exhibition that draws these parallels. So there's a fabulous flapper gown that Catherine wore in the 1920s, and you can see gowns like that in Steichen's photographs. There's a wonderful long evening gown that Mary wore in the 1930s, and so you can see the transition in fashion from the 1920s to the 30s, and then you can see gowns like that in Steichen's photographs, in addition to amazing diamond jewelry by Van Cleef & Arpels and Cartier, and fabulous cloche hats from the 1920s, and then this just show-stoppingly beautiful bright red Chanel scarf. And so you can go back and forth and make these connections between what Steichen was doing, capturing these elements of fashion, and what Catherine and Mary were doing at Rinalda in purchasing amazing things for themselves and for their own home.
When I look at some of these works, I'm struck with this connection between me and the individual being photographed in so many cases. Maybe it's the dress, maybe it's just my unfamiliarity with that period in time, but there's a realness to that. But I'm curious about your take on this great photographer and what resonates with you.
Well, that's one of the most amazing things about Steichen's work is that he was a master on so many levels. He was a technical master. He could manipulate composition and manipulate light in order to focus the viewer's attention on a particular aspect of dress or face or expression. He could get from his subjects what he wanted from them. He could pull them out and make them more glamorous, more dramatic. He also had the ability, when he was working in a particularly commercial realm, to focus the viewer's attention on a product. So if he's photographing shoes, you are going to look at those shoes and they're going to be the most fabulous shoes you've ever seen. In so many ways, he's just a master at what he's doing. And this is really, I think, these years are kind of the height of his creative abilities and aesthetic sensibilities.
Well, maybe we could take a look at a few works that strike you and you can talk me through.
Sure.
So here we are in the Charlie and Mary Babcock wing of Rinalda House and the Edward Steichen Star Power exhibit. So, Allison, what's a piece that kind of touches base on, I guess at first we were talking about individuals, and this is really stunning right off the bat.
One of the most iconic photographs of 20th century art is Steichen's photograph of Gloria Swanson. She was a young actress when he photographed her in 1924, and it had been a long shoot. I think they were both exhausted. And he hit upon this idea of draping a film of lace in front of her face, and he said that she recognized the potential immediately. He said her pupils dilated, and she took on a look like a cat looking out from leaves in a jungle. And it's just one of the most dramatic photographs you'll see, and just stunning in its beauty.
Cat-like. What a great way of putting that. It's exactly what it is. And the texture of the lace in the face is really striking, too. How about another in terms of drawing your eye, drawing your attention to a fashion element, Allison?
I'm glad you asked that, because in this same year, in 1924, he created this incredible photograph of Ilka Chase, who was the daughter of the editor of Vogue. And he wanted to highlight a new hair ornament, and it's a tortoiseshell band that wraps around the back of the head with beautiful diamond embellishments on the sides. And so he posed her with her back to the camera and focuses on just the beauty of her profile and this incredible hairband. And I think for our visitors, this image is really going to call to mind Downton Abbey and perhaps Lady Mary and something fabulous that she would have worn in that show.
I'm also struck by the modern, as in contemporary, 21st century look of some of these photos and the gorgeous detail. In that one, it's reminiscent of the modern day headphones that are worn backwards today by the young kids.
Exactly. Steichen was very modern, and you see him throughout the exhibition becoming more and more modern. In the 20s, when he started, he was still doing this soft focus, what we call pictorialist photography. But as you move through the exhibition, you see him becoming sharper, the images become crisper, there are these very deep shadows, and you see him moving from almost an Art Nouveau look to very much Art Deco.
Another thing you'll see at the Star Power exhibit, Edward Steichen, is a lot of items that you won't see probably anywhere else, certainly not up close in such beautiful display, beginning with this ruby work on the far right.
Yes, we have a platinum ruby and diamond necklace by Cartier in a case. And next to it, we have a fantastic Van Cleef & Arpels diamond bracelet. And these, of course, come from the family. They're almost never on view here. They're kept in a very safe place. But this exhibition gives us the opportunity to bring these out of storage and let our visitors see some of the personal items that the family would have had.
And these photographs, many of them grouped by year and all the way through 1935, beginning in 1923.
This is another incredibly striking photograph that Steichen created. We've moved now to 1929, and this is the photograph that he did of Greta Garbo. And Greta Garbo arrived in the studio for the shoot, and she had this incredibly elaborate hairdo. And Steichen said, "Oh, it's too bad that we're doing this with that movie star hair." And she said, "Oh, this terrible hair." And she put her hands up to her head, and she smoothed her hair back from her face. And he said, at that moment, the magnificence of her beauty was revealed, and it was that moment that he captured in the image. And so you just see her incredible face just confronting the viewer with this very extraordinary directness. It's just an amazing photograph.
That's what strikes me with great photographers throughout history, the connection with the subject and the subject letting down their guard in a way that I guess that's what makes him a great photographer.
And he apparently had the talent to do that. He could really get what he needed from his subjects. He could draw them out of their shells and really focus on what made them unique as artists or as politicians or musicians or athletes. He could focus on that aspect of their personality and appearance.
You know, looking around the room, maybe it's because of the way these are grouped too, Allison, I see kind of an evolution in this process, but I can't put my finger on it. What's going on in Steichen's world just as a photographer during these years?
Absolutely. The exhibition is arranged chronologically. So we start in 1923 and we end in 1941. And you see him going from this soft focus pictorialist style in the beginning in 1923 to, by the time you get to the 30s, he has sharpened his focus. He's producing very crisp outlines, very deep shadows. You see it especially in this image of Martha Graham from 1931. Martha Graham was a founder of modern dance, and he captured her moving very slowly from one pose to another. And in this image, she's wearing this voluminous draped piece of clothing, and she has her hand very dramatically raised above her head, and there's almost a glow behind her. He lights her from behind, so you see the outline of her body and these very deep shadows. And again, I keep using the word iconic, but this is just one of the icons of 20th century photography. It's an extraordinary image.
Who are some of the other subjects that whom we've shot that we'd be familiar with?
Oh, Katharine Hepburn, Amelia Earhart. The one that we're all swooning over here at the museum is Gary Cooper, who's just devastatingly handsome. And Steichen captures his kind of long, lanky frame and his very intense, brooding stare. And we're all fighting with who gets to take that poster home when the exhibition ends.
What sort of feedback have you been getting from the viewers?
Well, we've had great reactions. Our State magazine called us one of the top five things to see for North Carolinians this month. On our opening weekend, we actually had Steichen's granddaughter here, and she was so impressed with the way that we made the exhibition interdisciplinary by integrating the costume and clothing elements and furniture. And then just this past weekend, we had a visit from NPR royalty. We had Susan Stamberg here. She toured the house with our director and then came through the exhibition. And apparently, she looked at every single photograph in the show. So I think she was here for quite a while. But, you know, I think she saw things that she had never seen in Steichen's work before. And that's what this exhibition is going to do for our visitors. Make everybody feel a little bit glamorous this spring.
Rinalda House curator Allison Slaby. Star Power, Edward Steichen's glamour photography, will remain on view through May 19th at Rinalda House Museum of American Art in Winston-Salem. You'll find several Steichen photos and links to more information about the exhibit on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and after this short break, it's time to take off with First in Flight Entertainment Theater Company and their mashup of some of your favorite Fable characters, plus a few surprises, all in one great musical, Into the Woods, Jr. We're off to the Actors Studio next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and First in Flight is an entertainment company here in the Triad that's in the process of opening their own theater entertainment complex, Black Box Theater, Scene Shop, and eventually an event center and main stage theater in 2015. First in Flight Entertainment Theater Company is their nonprofit theater organization, now in its second year, and next week they'll present a wonderful musical that the whole family can enjoy, Into the Woods, Jr.
Once upon a time,
I wish
in a far-off kingdom
more than anything.
It'll run Friday night, March 22nd, and Saturday the 23rd at 7, with a Saturday matinee at 2 at Southwest Elementary Auditorium. First in Flight director Aaron Diaz stopped by along with 13-year-old actors Peter Villasmil, who plays the wolf, and Sophie Davis, who plays the narrator, and 11-year-old Anna Kummer, who plays Granny.
Give us some milk more than anything.
I know nothing about Into the Woods, Jr. other than it sounds great because you get the best of all the fairy tales that are out there. How many different stories are quoted in this one?
About six.
Six? That's plenty.
Possibly even more if you think about it.
And yeah. I understand there are a few surprises in there as well.
Yes.
Throw them.
Yes, we have, surprisingly, Harry Potter coming out. We have
what?
Yeah.
We
I
have
know,
Dorothy coming out.
Dorothy.
Oh,
Wizard
my
of
gosh.
Oz, good stuff.
Those are two of my favorites. Anna, playing Granny, is it tough to take in that role and become an old person?
It's not really hard to get into it because she's sort of like sassy in the same way.
In the same way that you are?
Well, sort of, yeah.
What sorts of things do you need to work on to get into that role? What, for example, suggestions have you gotten from the director to hone that character?
Try to breathe through your like diaphragm to like yell out some of my lines that I have to yell out. So.
What's the most fun part about being Granny, though?
I kind of get to, like, fight sort of with Pete.
Aha.
So, yeah.
I understand. You're the wolf, Pete.
Yes.
Well, yeah, the wolf's this, you know, kind of cunning character who tries to eat a little girl, first eats her grandmother, eats the little girl, and then gets slaughtered, but survives in the end.
Thankfully, there's a happy ending for everybody, including the wolf, in this version
yes.
of Into the Woods.
Yes.
I want to chat with Sophie for a second because you are the narrator.
Yeah.
What's the biggest challenge of being a narrator for a show like this? I've never done it before.
Well, as the narrator, I'm on stage pretty much the entire time, so probably the most challenging thing for me is to stay engaged the entire time. But it's really fun because while I'm telling little tidbits about the show, the other characters are putting it on and making it really visual, and I kind of give you the behind-the-scenes look at what's really going on, and they really put it on as the big show.
You take your breath, you're getting ready to read. What are you thinking about?
I have to use a lot of diction because I'm telling the crowd what's going on and what's just really happening in the show, and I have to use a lot of projection so everyone can hear me and use my arms and use just a lot of body language so that it can really present the other characters who are about to do dialogue or a scene.
You speak so clearly. I imagine you're going to be an excellent narrator for this one. What sorts of things do you learn in a play in the context of this discipline, for lack of a better way of putting it, that you use in other parts of your life?
Well, since this show's a musical, music also contains some mathematical parts to it. So kids out there, listen to music. It helps you with math.
I've heard that there's a direct connection between mathematics and music theory. And I was so hopeful because I'm a musician that would help me my math. But I was just terrible at math. Okay, so it helps you in math. Anna, how about you?
It also helps you if you're like shy, you know, and it's like your first play and you're like learning how to be like not shy anymore in front of people. It helps you to like talk to people in front of like big giant crowds.
Well, I've learned that, you know, you get to be yourself when you act and all, and that you get to play all these different characters. And, you know, being yourself is right now a big problem for some kids because, you know, they're afraid that what if their selves isn't cool enough or something like that. But they've really taught me that being yourself is something actually good and you can learn a lot from it.
Hear, hear. Hats off to you. Does this play call into some dance as well?
Yes, I'm pretty sure we're going to have a dancing forest in this one, which is going to be a tap number, which is going to be really fun because tapping is really fun because you can hear all the rhythm in it, and it's really catchy, and it's just really fun because there's a lot of movement in it.
First in Flight, the theater company. How long has it been around? And I understand there's some big changes afoot.
It's true. Well, First in Flight Entertainment is our entertainment company, and that will always stand as First in Flight Entertainment. We started the business. This is coming up on our fifth year, which is really exciting. So that's a great accomplishment right there, and we're really excited about moving forward. But the theater company started off where I just really wanted to kind of give back to kids, because that's my biggest thing. I love teaching kids. I love our lessons together, guys. I do. I have so much fun, and I love directing kids and just seeing how it changes their lives, just like the kids were just talking about.
Yeah.
And we started out doing a production of Mulan Jr. a couple of years ago, and from that we really realized that, oh, these junior productions are pretty great. So we kind of kept doing them, and we did Willy Wonka and Seussical and Annie and Les Mis, and I mean many different junior productions. And just this last year, we got incorporated as a nonprofit organization, and now we have a board of directors together, and we are starting, for now we're calling it the Fife Theater Company. We're actually going to be having a rebranding for the theater company and a big announcement in the fall, which I'm excited about.
Great.
And from that, we are going to have a space, an entertainment complex, starting with a black box theater, moving on to a scene shop and an event center, and then a full main stage theater. And it is going to be the, for lack of a better term right now, we're calling it the First in Flight Entertainment Complex. And we really want it to be a place where we can have our kids' productions performed, we can have our community theater productions performed, we can have professional theaters come in, we can do showcases of some of First in Flight Entertainment's professional performers, like Letters from Home. And so it's going to be a really great adventure, and it's so exciting. I just signed the contract to get the renderings done with the architect last week, and we're moving forward fast.
Holy smokes. Well, geez, I mean, where's this going to be? Where's the complex going to be?
That is still TBA. Okay. For the public.
All right.
I'll tell you after we're off the air. No, just kidding.
Very good. See, I get privy to all this great gossip. First in Flight is a neat concept and new for many of our listeners. Talk about that and say I'm having an event, and what if I needed a Marilyn Monroe or a Knight in Shining Armor?
Oh, yeah, we can do all that. In fact, we do things as small as singing telegrams and as large as humongous corporate events. One of the last events we did was a alchemy party where we had magicians and mental and actresses dressed up, handing out essential oils, and we had a band that was playing different kind of ambiance music in the background, and we had a host. So we've got things like that. We've also got, we do a lot of murder mystery parties for corporate events. We have touring groups that are going all over the country performing for different organizations, VFWs and different corporations. So it's been a big adventure. It's amazing. When we started the company, we had about 50 entertainers that we worked with in the local area, and now we've got over 600 entertainers that we work with that are magicians, contortionists, fire eaters, singers, dancers, actors, and it's pretty awesome.
He was a famous trumpet man from out Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft.
It seems like one of the more successful groups that have spun out of Fife is Letters from Home.
Absolutely. Letters from Home is my favorite group that we've gotten together, and it's really grown into its own entity of its own. It's been so wonderful. It's a three-part harmony group that tap dances and sings, and we've been touring the country. We're actually into 11 different states now, which is exciting.
Wow.
And we have some overseas possibilities coming up for the next couple months, which is really exciting.
Neat.
And we are really, our mission is to honor veterans and active military by touring the country and singing, bringing back those good old 1940s memories. And we're actually getting into starting to do some other songs, still staying in the style of the 1940s, but expanding. So we'll be doing stuff from the 60s, 70s, and even up until today.
Yeah, and your all's voices blend so well, extremely convincing. And having seen you all perform a few times now, it's not just the voices, the movements, the look, the costumes. I mean, you really feel like it really transports.
We have a good old time. My favorite part about the show, Letters from Home, is with the audience interaction, for sure.
Yeah, well, they're definitely engaged, and hats off.
Only happy faces bloom there.
My thanks to First in Flight Entertainment Theater Company founder, director Aaron Diaz, and child actors Peter V.S. Meal, Sophie Davis, and Anna Kummer. Into the Woods Jr. runs Friday, March 22nd, and Saturday the 23rd at 7 o'clock, with a Saturday matinee at 2 at Southwest Elementary Auditorium. You'll find links to ticket information and more of the great goings-on at Fife Theater Company, the new expansion of First in Flight Entertainment, and upcoming concerts by Letters from Home on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Roll it out, let's do the Beer Barrel Polka.
I'm David Ford, and we've got great music and dance on the way. First, Steinway artist Peter Karof will help us better understand classical music with a focus on Edvard Grieg from the piano bench. Then we walk a mile in the shoes of a premier ballerina. Former ABT principal dancer Susan Jaffe is waiting in the wings. And North Carolina composer Kenneth Frizzell is here to pass the time with the world premiere of his new composition for clarinet, piano, and violin, A Book of Days, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is Understanding Classical Music with Karof at the keyboard.
That's the beginning of a very beautiful piece by Edvard Grieg, the Norwegian composer. Composed about 1890, and it's called Nocturne. The name, Nocturne, or the title, I think evokes, of course, things of the night, but also it's probably Grieg's homage to Frédéric Chopin, who, after all, wrote the most famous set of nocturnes way back in the early part of the 19th century. Now, this piece, Grieg's Nocturne, it's funny. It starts with very tentative, almost no melody at all. Its accompaniment here. And the melody just has two notes. And then it's almost as if it can't bring itself to say any more. And then a little bit later it goes. Very tentative and very shy. Part of this tentative quality is the fact that this rhythm and the accompaniment is stopped in the middle with these what are called ties. So the downbeat is tied over, it's not restruck. Another aspect that gives it its sort of tentative and sort of almost floaty quality is the fact that the left hand is in this kind of triple meter, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. But the right hand is in a duple meter. Slowly shifting harmonies create this mood of reflection. Now, about halfway through the piece, there's a middle section, a contrasting area, in which suddenly we hear this. And then again, a little higher. Does that sound like a bird to you? It does to me. And since this is a nocturne, it's a night bird. It's probably a nightingale. In fact, it might be a musical depiction of an actual bird that Grieg might have heard one evening. And maybe that nightingale reminds Grieg of something from his past because suddenly the music becomes much more agitated and excited. As if that nightingale recalls a long-lost love of Grieg, who knows? What beautiful harmonies those are. They're just so luminous. He gets that luminosity by adding all sorts of extra notes to the chords. Almost impressionistic. Well, after all that excitement, we return back to the opening. And our nightingale makes an appearance once more at the very end. And so on. And finally, at the very end, instead of the traditional cadence, or perhaps instead we have C major going to E minor, and then back. Very personal use of the harmonic language of the end of the 19th century. Edvard Grieg's beautiful Nocturne for piano from 1890.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Mr. Peter Karoff at the keyboard. That's Understanding Classical Music on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and composer Kenneth Frizzell is here to talk us through his new composition a little later on in the show. The world premiere is coming to the Seacrest Artist Series this month, but first, it's time to dance. The UNC School of the Arts just wrapped up a successful winter dance performance that was highlighted by one of the most challenging choreographies in modern dance, D-Man in the Waters by Bill T. Jones. Next up, it's Spring Dance, which opens this year on April 20th with Shen Wei's Rite of Spring, Nijinsky's Je and Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, and a world premiere ballet by School of Dance Dean Susan Jaffe. It's set to Borodin's Polovetsian Dances. In setting her new choreography, Susan will no doubt be calling on her decades of professional dance experience. She was the principal dancer with American Ballet Theater for 20 years. She stopped by in December to talk Nutcracker with me and to answer a few selfish questions I had about her remarkable career. Your early work as a dancer for really two decades with the finest ballet ensemble in the country, dance ensemble, American Ballet Theater. First off, let's put it in perspective. Doing what you did, getting where you were, what did it take to get to do what you did, the competition, just to put it in perspective?
I actually don't even know what the statistics are, but if you talk to just about any grown woman, she will say to you, oh, I took ballet. And so almost everybody I've ever met, any female I have ever met, has taken ballet in their life when they were a child. But then as you get older, you start getting into your teenage years, it really is very apparent who will be a dancer and who will not. You not only need the, particularly for ballet, the right body type with the right measurements, and your neck has to be this long and your arms have to be that long and your legs, but also be very coordinated, which is a God-given. I mean, of course, you can educate yourself, but really coordination is also education and God-given. And also just very, very intelligent with your physicality. And on top of all of that, you're an actor. So you have to be able to tell a story or to be able to tell an emotion through your dance. So it really... out of a school, let's say out of every year, a graduating school may get 3 or 4 people into main companies. Now, let's say a graduating class is 40 people, 50 people. Mm. So that means only 3 or 4 are getting into a main company. It's pretty tough out there.
Yeah. I got to ask, 20 years as premier ballerina in ABT, how do you navigate the expectations of the critics, the public, your audiences, year after year, for successive years like that? That just strikes me as, I put that in the realm of Roger Federer being number one in the world for 5 years in a row. It's incredible to me. How do you do it? How did you do that?
Mostly, I did not pay attention to what critics were talking about
me because oftentimes I would go to a performance and I would watch a performance and then I would see what the reviewer said about the performance and it looked like the two of us were at a completely different performance. So, you know, it really is subjective. And I also believe that whatever a critic has to say about what I'm doing really has nothing to do with my path. So I really used the trajectory of my life as an artist as a path, as a journey, not that every performance is a finished product. It's just part of the journey, part of the artist's journey. And I needed to protect that, you know, and to nurture that part of my own journey. And so I just kept making sure that each step was a new opening, and another door and another door. And so, yeah, paid very little attention to critics. And just like Federer, you know, you can see him when you're watching him play. He doesn't hear the audience, you know, and you see that laser beam focus. He's almost completely unaware that there is an audience around him. And that's how you really have to be as an artist in a way. You have to connect to the audience, but not allow the audience to make you afraid. In fact, I used to say to myself, you know, this is my home, and I'm welcoming you into my home, into my heart and my soul, and I'm telling you this story. So in a way, when the curtain went up, it was almost, for me, it made me feel better if I felt like I was just giving and embracing the audience, as opposed to, oh, that's a scary audience out there, and I have to balance on one toe in front of 4,000 people, you know. So it's really a whole mindset, and you have to change it so where it's you're bringing them into your world.
I think you've just answered the other question along those lines I wanted to ask, which is, you know, which personal characteristics you possess to enable you to have that kind of longevity in the career. But that mindset that you just articulated there just seems to speak volumes to that. Did you acquire that over years and years, or did you go into it with that kind of inner confidence and perspective?
Oh, no. It took me years, I think, to basically train my mind. And athletes train their mind, and dancers have to train their mind, because your mind without training, without focus, is like a wild horse. And it's got all this energy, but it's just going to run in any direction, positive or negative. So as an athlete and as a dancer, you have to pull that all that energy into a laser-focused beam. And that requires work. It requires study. Of course, I did a lot of studying. In fact, for years and years and years, I practiced meditation just to make sure that my mind could tame that wild horse and bring it into where I wanted to go. And also that the idea of, and I'm still like this, I have to know where I'm going. If I have the end in mind, then I can get there. If I don't have an end in mind, I just kind of throw myself out and it's sort of luck is wherever it is, wherever it lands. But so it's that goal of where you want to be that keeps you moving forward. But also as a dancer, perseverance is really a big attribute to success, and also to use every situation as an opportunity rather than a success or a failure. So you really have to walk with a lot of humility, because you need to be very, very open. You have to recognize your limitations and also recognize where you can go. And it keeps you humble. It really does. It's such a difficult art form that you have to be on top of yourself as a human being, as an artist, and somebody who takes opportunity and doesn't let yourself implode if something is difficult, if you have an adverse situation. But just to keep going, you know.
University of North Carolina School of the Arts Dean of the School of Dance, Susan Jaffe. UNCSA's Spring Dance opens this year on April 20th with Shen Wei's Rite of Spring, Nijinsky's Je, and Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, and a world premiere by my guest Susan Jaffe, set to Borodin's Polovetsian Dances. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org, and just click on Triad Arts Weekend. From Borodin to Book of Days now. That's a new composition by North Carolina composer Kenneth Frizzell. The University of North Carolina School of the Arts professor was resident composer with the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, and he's written works for a veritable who's who of world-renowned performers, including cellist Yo-Yo Ma, soprano Dawn Upshaw, and choreographer Bill T. Jones, just to name a few. Later this season, the Columbus and North Carolina Symphonies will be performing Ken's works, and coming up later this month, the Seacrest Performance Series in Winston-Salem will present Strada in a world premiere of Ken's new work titled A Book of Days. The work is for violin, clarinet, and piano, and it's based on passages from one of Wake Forest University's most famous alumni, poet, author, educator A.R. Ammons. The performance is Thursday night, March 28th at 7:30 in Brendel Recital Hall on the Wake Forest University campus. Ken dropped by recently to talk about composition, his new work, A Book of Days, and the ensemble that'll premiere it, Strada, which is violinist, violist James Stern, clarinetist Nathan Williams, and pianist Audrey Andrist.
I was in a bookstore in New York. There was only one of them called Barnes & Noble.
Oh, that's right, that Barnes & Noble.
Down on Fifth Avenue and 18th Street, I think.
Uh-huh.
And I was just going through poetry. I was sitting on the floor, and I grabbed a book by A.R. Ammons. I started with the A's, fortunately. And there it was, this great book called Tape for the Turn of the Year. And it really changed my life to discover that gorgeous book.
At that sitting, was there a feeling or a something that his poetry embodied that you still can, you know, you recall, you tap
I
into?
I do. It was very tactile. I mean, Tape for the Turn of the Year was actually written on a roll of adding machine tape, which ended up taking a couple of months. And then he transcribed it into, you know, regular book form. But he didn't change anything about the layout. So that the way that poem kind of unfurled down the page was really dynamic to me. It just seemed like exactly like a visual, poetic manifestation of what music does, which is, you know, exist in time. And Ammons is known for not liking to use periods. He uses a colon usually, which implies some kind of forward motion. Just the sound of the language and the way the thing looked on the page, it really grabbed me. It reminded me of what words can do that are, you know, like music. The whole poem has a kind of energy. Yeah. And he addresses, you know, oh, I feel like I'm getting toward the end of the halfway mark or that kind of thing. And he talks about the unraveling of the tape as he's writing, and it's almost like a visual image of time passing, which is one thing that I wanted to explore in this new piece.
Talk about how you wind up translating Ammons' images about time into music.
Well, I began by rereading the book a couple of times. I took a trip to the Southwest this summer, and I had it in my motel room, so it was great to be in this kind of barren geological landscape and think about geologic time.
Yeah.
And he explores every realm of time that I can think of in the book. And I just started underlining things. I was just gathering information. When I got home, I kind of organized a lot of those phrases. There were dozens of them.
But phrases that really stuck with you somehow.
Absolutely. And yeah. I knew that the piece had something to do with days and also had to deal with the passage of time. Because the book itself, Ammons writes Tape for the Turn of the Year as a diary. He tells you the beginning of each day what the date is, and then he's just exploring all these mind-bending cosmic shapes of time within that kind of thing. So I was thinking about different kinds of time, different ways that the days pass, places that the mind wanders. I had already written a lot of the music and had a vague sense of what each piece was about, but there were many phrases that would have suited each movement that were very similar. People talk about how abstract music is, and it certainly is in a way, and yet I think any way that a composer can point the listener in to whatever our images are or our, quote, extra musical thoughts, it just takes away a layer of distance. So I love titles that way because I really do think they can let the listener in a specific way.
All day life itself is bending, weaving, changing, huge concepts. How do you begin to do that as the composer? How do you begin to evoke those sorts of feelings through the music? I mean, you've got a blank sheet of lined staff paper there. I know you do all of your composing with pen and ink like they did 500 years ago.
I do. I'm a relic. Well, that first movement, I had an image of how the mind perceives the day. I mean, that these ideas are bending and changing and shifting. And, you know, we literally have multi-thousands of images and words that race through our mind every day. And I wanted the music to kind of convey that idea of the shiftingness of time and with this great group Strada, I have, you know, these three great virtuosos. I thought, you know, you've got a wind instrument, a string instrument, a piano, three entirely different sound worlds. So what about if each of those players is quote, daydreaming, and they go off into little drifts and don't necessarily have to create a continuous line? And something that I very much admire in the music of late Debussy, which is this idea of fragmentation and this idea of the ephemerality of time, and how you think you've got something, you think, oh, he's starting to form a melody now, and then it's gone. Like, it's got a wispy quality that has to do with time passing and of loss, really, that you can't pin it down. So that's what I tried to explore in that opening.
And you've been composing for decades.
Decades.
All right, we'll just leave it at that. Over that time, I'm wondering, have you developed any tendencies?
I love the challenge of moving from one piece, so like an orchestra piece, where you know you just can't do the most outrageous rhythms that you hear. There has to be, when you write for orchestra, you have to reconsider things about, you know, complex rhythms and things like that in rehearsal time. When you write chamber music, for people of this caliber, there are no stops, which is great. It's a great fun to do that.
Yeah. The variety of sounds, is that something you draw on in when you're composing? Or are you looking to grab from this various registers, or is that even a concern of yours?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in a trio such as this, because the instruments are so different from each other, that you want to think, I mean, if you've got the clarinet that has at least three or four different distinct characters, so does the violin, so does the piano. So you've really, you can think orchestrally, you can think of ways that they cross each other, that they go underneath and over each other in unexpected ways. We don't usually think of the piano sustaining like wind instruments or strings, but I like to sort of exchange the typical roles and places and absolutely explore as much color and contrast as possible.
I love it when, and you've done, I can't remember the work, but you did this thing where the attack is the piano and then the woodwind sustains it string sustains it. That effect is, that's a neat one. Give me an example of some other, I mean, besides Over and Under, like a compositional technique that you would employ in this work that was satisfying for you.
Well, there's a very short second movement after the kind of daydream fragmentary movement called Paper in Thin Air. And it goes by very fast. It's only 45 seconds, I believe. And I believe the violin starts it, and it's just playing at a breakneck presto tempo that's almost like some kind of electronic hoedown or something. And each of the instruments in turn, the clarinet and the piano, imitate it literally. It's almost a fugal kind of thing that would have been done 300 years ago, but with more of a, because of the way it kind of draws upon almost like folk fiddling, not literally, but it almost has a kind of pop music effect to it, and it's very fleeting and goes by very quickly. And I thought about, Ammons loves writing about the mundane. You know, I went to Macy's and bought a CD, that kind of thing. It would have been a record in his day. But he talks a lot about grotesque, silly, everyday things, you know, what he had for dinner, that kind of thing. The minutia of, the paper in thin air to me has a lot to do with just the image of the adding machine tape, or in my case, the paper that I compose on, and thin air, you know, the idea of something, it's not stated clearly, but the idea of the paper vanishing into thin air, or the music on the paper is ephemeral. So I love that very simple image of paper and thin air. And so that's why that movement has such a rapid kind of appearance and disappearance quality.
It's kind of like music in that sense. I mean, it's that rare art form that disappears. After the performance is done, you're just left with the same air that was vibrating moments ago.
That's right.
Yeah. How do you reconcile that thought?
I'm just glad I'm not a performer, because performers really aren't left with anything. At least as a composer, you're left with the blueprint that you created, which is the score. So that's my justification for getting up in the morning and keeping at it. I mean, it is a horrible thought to think that, I mean, people spend hundreds and hundreds of hours preparing for a concert that's over in an hour and a half, and it's gone. Even if it went beautifully, it's gone, which is sort of what the last movement of this piece is about. But I do take a little bit of reassurance that there is at least a score that other people can, you know, reproduce the experience over and over again if they choose of playing the piece.
UNCSA professor and Winston-Salem-based composer Kenneth Frizzell. You'll find links to the complete performance calendar of Ken's works on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. In the meantime, you can be the first to hear violinist-violist James Stern, clarinetist Nathan Williams, and pianist Audrey Andrist perform Ken's new work, A Book of Days. Together they are Strada, and their world premiere performance is Thursday night, March 28th at 7:30 in Brendel Recital Hall on the Wake Forest University campus. Also on that program will be works by American composer William Bolcom, Max Bruch, and Alexander Arutyunyan. You'll find links to ticket information and more at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. That's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend along with pictures and lots of helpful links on our website, wfdd.org, and just click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. We leave you now with the ensemble Strada in performance. This is violinist-violist James Stern, clarinetist Nathan Williams, and pianist Audrey Andrist performing music by Robert Maggio, composed in 1999 just for the group. It's titled Riddle. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend. Thank you.